Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay, and I'll be the host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, October 5th, 2025. And the share ID numbers for Friday, October 3rd, are the following for the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting. That number is 22,840. That's 22840. For the 10 a.m. meeting on Friday, 22,841. That's 22841. This morning, A Vision for You presents Altruism and the 12-Step Way of Life. You know, the 12 steps are what we learn is they're a sequential program of spiritual action. So that of course, means that each step is meant to be completed in order, one after the other, and the steps, well, they really build on one another. They create a framework for spiritual growth and for recovery. And so what are we recovering from? Well, we recover from this merciless obsession that drives us to eat compulsively. And that is driven out. And there's many other wonderful things that happen as a result of recovery. You have to find that out for yourself as you continue this journey. But I would offer to you the following shorthand for the sequencing of the steps, the order of the steps. And steps 1, 2, and 3 bring you into harmony with God, with your higher power. Steps 4 through 7 bring you into harmony with yourself. 8 and 9 bring you into harmony with others. And 10, 11, and 12 keep you in harmony with God, with yourself, and with others. And so as we move through the steps, the experiences and insights gained from each one, they inform and prepare us for the next step. So skipping steps, as I did, many people do early on, or approaching them out of order, it really negates the effectiveness of the process. After all, the big book tells us what half measures avail us. So each step serves as a foundation for a deeper surrender. Each step builds towards a more profound relationship with power. That's the whole idea here, a power greater than us. And when we immerse ourselves in the practical program of action, what happens? Well, we're brought into congruence with our Creator, and it's not a perfect alignment, you know, but it is indeed a sufficient alignment. Because striving for absolute perfection can actually, I found, hinder me from being a demonstration of God's creative divinity. And the big book is clear on what happens to the mental obsession when we undergo a spiritual awakening, this change. The obsession, again, is driven out. It's eradicated. And that's really indeed what happens. And page 85 confirms this. It says, we feel, though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, we've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for us. Now, when the obsession is eradicated, perhaps some of us felt, I did, that I can finally coast along, you know, just kind of coast. And yet the very next paragraph on page 85 provides a warning of complacency, and it says, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. And you know what, Larry, you're going to be headed for trouble if you do, because food is a subtle foe. There's no cure, not cured of alcoholism, not cured of compulsive eating. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So how am I going to do that? How does one maintain this recovered state of being? Well, let's find out. So joining us this morning to share her personal experiences and insights on step 12 is Nancy J. And Nancy, although we try to claim her in Illinois, she's a recovered compulsive overeater from Tennessee now. We love Tennessee. And she's dedicated to this 12-step way of life and carrying a message of hope to our fellowship. And so it's with much gratitude, tremendous appreciation that we welcome her to the line this morning. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you so much for the beautiful introduction. And what I want to talk about this morning is the 12-step way of life and the idea of altruism. And for those people on the line who have seen that word as they've gone through the big book, they know that that's part of our program. And what I want to talk about today is exactly how that influences our design for living, the way we work our program. I want to start out with a prayer. And this is something that I feel could be helpful. It's something that I wrote myself. And it's a reminder to myself about not being afraid in this world that we all live in, but to rely on a higher power. It's a poem called Cross the Bridge. And I wrote it, I think, about 2 years ago. And keep in mind that I was an atheist when I started in this program a little more than 10 years ago. Cross the bridge. Cross the bridge. Do not be afraid. Many others have safely crossed before you. The bridge is strong and only 12 steps long. Go quickly across the bridge. Don't look down. Don't slow down. Just go forward. A trusted guide will go before you. Cross the bridge step by step. Look ahead. As you go across the bridge, your legs feel stronger and steadier. You feel a new power. As you step off the bridge onto land, you look around with amazement. You are in a new world of spiritual purpose, freedom from food obsession, service to others. It is a design for living that works in rough going. Now, I started out by saying I was an atheist about 10 years ago. I don't put a label on what I am now, but I do know this, that I have entered a world of the spirit, that I no longer feel alone, that everywhere I am, I can talk to something, and I don't even worry about the label of what that something is, but I can talk to something that helps me whenever I ask for help. It is amazing for someone who was an atheist to come into this program and find such tremendous help. So I want to tell you my story. At first, at the beginning of this presentation, I want to tell you a little bit about me and who I am. And my great hope is that somebody out there, I'm speaking out there right now to the great beyond, I don't know who is on the phone listening, but I hope that somebody will be helped because we all need help. And I certainly got tremendous help from this program, and it is a privilege to be speaking to you today. I want to start out talking about my childhood. I was born May 24th, 1945, to a very wonderful traditional Jewish family in New York. I was born in Brooklyn, New York. And when I say a traditional Jewish family, I don't mean that we were Orthodox Jews. I mean that we were very strongly identifying as Jews. We celebrated all the Jewish holidays. We had bar mitzvahs in our family. We had rabbis in our family. We were very devoted to the idea of being Jewish and being part of the Jewish people. But nobody in our family that I ever saw actually prayed to God for some kind of personal help or personal communication. It was more in the spirit of, I'm a member of the Jewish people. And it never occurred to me to try to communicate with God on a personal level. And as I say, we had a wonderful family. I had very devoted grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. I had a brother, an older brother. And my father was an attorney. I eventually became an attorney. And my mother stayed at home. She was a very, very immaculate kind of housekeeper. My clearest memory of my mother is her washing the kitchen floor after we had dinner every night. She just kept the house super clean. My father used to say she was too clean. And so she loved to keep the house in beautiful, immaculate order. And we eventually moved out to Freeport, which is out on Long Island, right on the Atlantic Ocean. And the reason we moved to Freeport from Brooklyn is even though my father always had his law office in Brooklyn, in downtown Brooklyn, he would travel every day on the Long Island Railroad and commute an hour into New York so that he could have a boat in Freeport. It was started out as a very small boat. He loved the water. He loved boating. And that's why he picked Freeport. And if you've heard of Jones Beach, that's Freeport. And so I grew up in Freeport. And I had a very wonderful life until I was 9 years old. And I was I wouldn't say I was skinny, but I was a slim girl. And my parents were slim. My brother was slim. There really were no heavy people in my family. And food was just food. I enjoyed food, but it was never an obsession. It was never something that I spent much time thinking about. And I was an outgoing kid. I loved to play. I had lots of friends. And I had what I would call a very happy life. But one day when I was 9 years old, my father came to my school out in Freeport during the day, which was very unusual because he was always working in Brooklyn during the week. But he came to the school door and he talked to the teacher and he took me to my aunt's house. And she lived in Levittown, which is another town out on Long Island. And I loved being there. I loved this aunt and this uncle and my cousins. And my father said, "You're going to spend the weekend here." And I didn't think anything about it. I had a wonderful weekend. The end of the weekend, my father came out to Levittown and drove me home back to Freeport. Nothing was said in the car. And I walk into the house, and there's all my relatives, and everybody's crying. And my father took me into a bedroom and he said, "Nancy, you know your mother has been sick for a long time." Now, I knew she had a back issue, but I didn't know it was anything, you know, serious. And my father said, "You know, she's been very sick, Nancy." And I just looked at him and I said, "You mean?" And he shook his head, and that's all he ever told me about my mother's dying. It turns out she had cancer for many years. But in those days, I think there was kind of a taboo about cancer. It was right after World War II. And my father was a wonderful man, a very loving man, but quiet. And that's all he ever said. And it turns out my mother was already dead and buried by the time I walked into that house. They didn't want to expose me to the funeral. Very protective. And so, of course, this is traumatic. This is confusing to somebody who's 9 years old. And I remember thinking, "I'm going to go to school tomorrow." A lot of sympathy. And when I went to school the next day, nobody said a word. The teacher didn't say a word. Nobody said a word about "your mother died" or "I'm sorry, your mother." Nothing. It was as if nothing had ever happened. My father eventually remarried, and this woman turns out was mentally ill, and she died of cancer my senior year of high school after having her leg amputated due to cancer. Well, life went on. I went to college. I eventually married. And by the way, I've been married 56 years to the same wonderful man, very fortunate in that department. And today I have 3 adult children, 7 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. So I've been very blessed in many ways. But once I got pregnant, after I graduated from college and I got pregnant and I had children, and these were wonderful children and very healthy, blessed pregnancies. But after I was at home with the children, something happened. And I don't know whether it was trauma, unresolved trauma, or what happened, but it was like if somebody flipped a switch in my brain. And all of a sudden, all I was interested in doing was being with my children in the living room. We lived in Rogers Park in Chicago at the time. And flipped a switch in my brain, and all of a sudden, all I wanted to do was be in my living room with my babies and watch soap operas and eat food. That was what interested me and what was my pleasure at that time of my life. All of a sudden, and I would buy bags of groceries, and I would watch soap operas all day. And pretty soon I was eating quantities of food. I remember I went out and bought a big rack of spare ribs. And I always loved spare ribs, which is ironic because I eventually became a vegetarian. But I was a tremendous meat eater. And I bought a big rack of spare ribs, and I put them in a giant roasting pan, and I took a bottle of barbecue sauce and poured it all over the spare ribs, put the roasting pan in the oven, made a giant pan of spare ribs, and spent the whole day watching soap operas, watching my children, and eating just huge quantities of food. I was somebody that thought nothing of eating 12 bagels or the whole loaf of bread. And all of a sudden, I was over 100 pounds overweight. And so I tried all the things that all of us have tried to lose weight. And I found out through my adult lifetime that I can lose weight and lose weight pretty effectively because I seem to have a decent metabolism. But my problem is I cannot keep the weight off. And I didn't know until I was exposed to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the doctor's opinion, the idea that we have a built-in forgetter in our brain, a mental twist. And it has always baffled me why I can lose the weight, you know, over 100 pounds many times, but I cannot keep it off. So I joined Overeaters Anonymous when I was in my early 30s. And I was in OA for about 4 or 5 years, and then I went to law school. And I waited till my children were in school until I started law school. And I went to law school during the day while they were in school. And I went to Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. It was a wonderful law school. I enjoyed it very much. But in the process of going to law school, I lost contact with my program that I had. My OA program, the picture of me graduating from law school shows my sponsor. It's one of the people who came to my law school graduation, my OA sponsor, a beautiful woman named Mary C. from Naperville. She has since passed away. She was just wonderful. And so then I was kind of on my own trying these different programs. Halfway measures avail us nothing. Larry mentioned that in the introduction. It certainly was true for me. I tried all kinds of halfway measures in all the years that I went to law school and then became a lawyer, a practicing lawyer. And I kept that up until I was 77 years of age, and then I retired. Today, I am 80 years of age. What I want to talk about today are the 10 years since I came back to OA. I really consider I started OA when I was almost 70 years of age, but that isn't totally true because I had this earlier period in my young 30s. But there I was at 272 pounds, April 15th of 2015. And I actually came into the meeting April 2nd, but April 15th is when I really started on a food plan. And I didn't know if being almost 70 years old, if I would be able to lose over 100 pounds and keep it off. The main thing was keeping it off. I have always found that the maintenance part for me is the mentally tricky part because I start to tell myself, oh, you can have a little this and you can have a little that, and it never ends well. But there I was getting heavier by the day in April of 2015, and the only thing I could think of was to try OA again. So I went to a hospital in Aurora, Illinois, where we were living at the time, and I walked into the OA meeting, and when they said, welcome home, a tear just went down my cheek. I was so emotional about being there in an OA meeting and feeling safe and feeling that maybe this is a place where I will find help. And I got a sponsor, a lovely person named Jill, and I asked her to sponsor me, and she and I went through the 12 steps together. And in the process of going through the 12 steps, I also decided, and I was still a practicing attorney at the time, and I was a workaholic, which is not unusual for people like us. We do all or nothing. And I was the person, the attorney in the office, and I was an employment lawyer, showed up first thing in the morning and last one to leave at night. And I remember the people who came in to take care of our plants in our law firm were amazed at 10 o'clock at night. I was the only one in a big dark building still working. And they'd say to me, why are you here all by yourself? And I'd smile. I was the managing partner of that office. And I would say, well, I just wanted to get some things done. But I was the one who was there late every night. And what I finally concluded was there was something more important than me being there in my law office till 10 o'clock at night, and that was going to Overeaters Anonymous. It finally dawned on me that if I kept going the way I was going, I was going to be dead at my desk. I was already experiencing terrible nosebleeds, and I was starting to put so much weight on that I hardly had suits to wear to go to work. It was terrifying to be putting weight on at the rate I was putting weight on. And as I say, I was getting close to 70 years of age. So I went to OA, and I started to leave work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which for me at that time was almost like working part-time. But I left at around 4 or 5 o'clock every day. so that I could go and have an abstinent dinner and go to an OA meeting. And this was before Zoom, so I had to go to face-to-face meetings, and I found them all over the Chicago area. Every night I went to a different meeting. And it didn't matter if I had to travel over an hour in ice and snow in the brutal Chicago winters. I went to a meeting every single night, and I had my abstinent meals every day. The problem was when I got home to my very supportive husband, who did not mind me going to a meeting every night, by the way. I would say to him, "Do you mind that I'm doing this?" And this man, who has seen me in every size and shape, said to me, "Nancy, do what helps you. Do what helps you." And he just mentioned to me last night, we were talking last night about my recovery, and he said to me, "Nancy, I don't mind you putting all these hours in to Overeaters Anonymous. Sometimes I am a little lonely, but you were so depressed. It was hard to see you that depressed." Now, I wasn't aware that I was that depressed. I don't think I was in touch with my feelings. No, I wasn't. But my husband's attitude was, and it always has been, and this is such a blessing to me as his wife, "Do what helps you." And so I went every night to an OA meeting, even though I was working at a very high stress, very demanding job during the day. But then I come home at night, and this is the tough part. Walking into our home, and we lived in Geneva, Illinois at that time. Today, I live in Piperton, Tennessee, as Larry mentioned. We moved here to retire a year ago. But I walk into our home, and I would think, I am starving, because I had all the cues of walking into my house, into where I knew there was my kitchen and food. And I'm eating later at night is something that appeals to me anyway. So I walk into the house and I think, food. But I had a wonderful, blessed thought, which is, don't go anywhere near the kitchen. Go into your bedroom, get on your pajamas, and get into bed. Take your phone and see if you can find something on your phone that will be a substitute for eating. I got into bed, this was every night, and I searched on my phone Overeaters Anonymous, and I started to find wonderful people, members of Overeaters Anonymous, doing all kinds of presentations and talks and workshops, and every night I would listen. And one person in particular from Scottsdale, Arizona, went right into my heart. I thought, my goodness, this man has suffered. If there was hope for him, if there was recovery for him, I can do it too. And I would listen to him and listen to a lot of other people, a lot of other wonderful people. We're very blessed in this program to have so many people who are willing to share their program. And so that's what I would do. I wouldn't eat. I would come home, I'd be starving, but I'd run in the bedroom, put on my pajamas, and listened to people. Sometimes it took hours to fall asleep, but I wouldn't get out of bed. I wouldn't go anywhere near the kitchen. I would just keep listening. And I sometimes think that by listening to all these podcasts at night the way I did, especially in the first year of me on this program of going to a meeting every night, I sometimes think maybe I kind of had a hypnosis, that all these thoughts and these ideas while I was laying there asleep but not asleep, awake but not awake, just taking hours to fall asleep sometimes, being very hungry. I sometimes think that it all sank into my brain because I noticed as time went by and I went through the steps with my sponsor, as I'm going to meetings every night, I noticed it started to get easier. It started to become easier to just stick to my three meals a day. The cravings calmed down. And I think I started to just become a calmer person. You know, I remember, you know, because Larry is here, I'm going to mention Larry, our wonderful Larry Kay, who did our introduction. I remember once in the morning having a partners meeting at my law firm, and I sat in the parking lot outside the building, and I thought, I'm scared. I was starting to get in touch with my feelings, and I thought, I'm scared. I don't think that these other partners like me. I don't feel comfortable about going into this meeting. It was going to be a conference call. And I just have a lot of anxiety, and I could feel the anxiety, which I think is something that I couldn't totally feel when I was just stuffed with food. And I sat in my car, and I called Larry Kay, who I had met. We were both in OA in Illinois at that time. And I knew Larry, and I loved him very much. And I called Larry, and I was lucky enough to get him on the phone. I don't know if Larry still remembers. And I told him how I was sitting out in the parking lot, and I was scared. And he said a prayer with me, and he the set-aside prayer. And he said, Nancy, set aside everything you think you know, and just be open in this meeting, and just remember you're not alone. And that was so helpful to me. I also had the big book in my desk, and I would often look at the page 84 with step 10, and it would say, we've ceased fighting anyone, anything or anyone, and all the beautiful prayers and the way of life in that big book was right there in my desk. And it all helped me very, very much because, as I say, being a lawyer and in a very high-stress part of the legal profession, it was difficult, but I found this program helped me to deal with those feelings very much, very much. Now, I eventually lost over 100 pounds. I started at 272 pounds, and I ended up at 167 pounds. And for my height and my body build and all the loose skin that's on me, that seemed to be a good weight for me. And so what I decided to do was stay between 165 and 170 pounds. Because I thought, I want to pick a reasonable maintenance range and hope I don't put this weight back on, because I have lost 100 pounds and more than 100 pounds and put it back on again and again and again in my adult life. I don't want that to happen again. And so I had that maintenance range, and I'm one of those people that weighs myself every morning. That works for me. And I have been able to maintain, which is a miracle. And we're talking now over 10 years. And I just turned 80. I turned 80 May 24th and 2025. I turned 80. And I want to just mention, I wasn't planning on talking about this, but I think it'll show you what is so important in my life today, what's meaningful to me in my life today. I knew my 80th birthday was coming, and my children asked me if they could make me a party, which they ended up doing. And it was lovely, but I knew that I wanted to get myself something. And I thought, Nancy, what do you want? What do you want for your 80th birthday? And I had different thoughts, and it suddenly came to me, what I really want is a wonderful OA weekend. I want to be in that world of the spirit in an intense way that you feel when you go away to an OA weekend, and there is a speaker there who is going to talk about our beautiful way of life. That's what was important to me at 80 years of age. Nothing material, no lavish vacations. I wanted to go to an OA weekend, and I ended up finding one. One of our wonderful speakers from Canada had a weekend in Montreal. And I flew up to Montreal by myself, and I spent a beautiful weekend there, and that was my 80th birthday present to myself. And that brings me to the whole subject of our way of life. So I want to transition to the part of my talk that has to do with altruism. Now, it's interesting, if you look at the big book, which is what we call the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, if you look at the foreword to it, to the very first edition, and this, of course, is back in 1939, it's a very short foreword. It's really just a little more than one page. And they don't mention much in this foreword. Later editions will have longer forewords and mention many more subjects, but this first foreword is short. They mention on the first page of the foreword about why it's important to remain anonymous, why that was important to them, because I'm sure they felt that people reading the book would go, what is this anonymous thing? Why do you need that? So it looks like most of the foreword is devoted to that. But then when you turn to the next page, which is a little half of a page, they mention twice, we simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. And then it says again, we should like to be helpful to such cases. And that answers the question, why are you even bothering to write this book? The simple answer, the spiritual answer is to just be helpful. Now, I want to point out some other places in our book where it talks about altruism. And you know, I had the delightful job in preparation for this talk of going through the big book and looking for places where it talks about altruism. It's a lot of fun because it's such a happy subject, helping others with no expectation of reward, helping others without expecting for you to get some money or some present or something in return. And to go through the big book and look for places where that's mentioned, as I say, is a very pleasant task. And I found it everywhere, all over the big book. And I ended up with 17 places that I felt I wanted to mention this morning. So I'm going to mention them very briefly because of time. But here, when we look at the doctor's opinion, and now we're talking about the doctor's opinion on page XXVIII. The doctor, who's Dr. Silkworth, and he's not an alcoholic, but he is the director of this great hospital in New York to help people who are in trouble with drugs and alcohol. Dr. Silkworth wrote, we feel, after many years of experience, that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men, and there it means alcoholics, who have come into his treatment center, than the altruistic movement now growing among them. Now, that's quite a statement for Dr. Silkworth to make, because he is the director of a for-profit treatment center, a big hospital in New York, the town's hospital. But he's saying nothing helps these men more in terms of their rehabilitation than the altruistic movement. He's talking about our 12-step way of life, our program. He's talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, but for us, Overeaters Anonymous. And how honest and unselfish Dr. Silkworth was to make that statement. He's saying, you've contributed more than my hospital to the rehabilitation of these men. What a beautiful, generous statement on his part. And then we get to Bill's story on page 14 of the big book. It's where we turn next. And Bill, as we all know from reading his recovery story, the first chapter of the big book, and now I'm on page 14 of that story. Bill is laying in the hospital. It's towards the end of the page, on page 14. And he gets a thought, and I think of this as a vision, a beautiful vision, because you can picture Bill laying in his bed in town's hospital, and a thought came to him that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. To me, that is the most stunning altruistic vision. That here he is, a man who is really at death's door and just had the experience of going through the steps and was feeling a beautiful recovery, as it's described on page 14, where he says, God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Bill is laying there, having just experienced this amazing spiritual experience. And what is he thinking about? He's thinking about helping others. He's thinking about the thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. And that's the vision that I think underlays everything we do in our program. We're trying to give others what had been so freely given to me. And that's the thought I had before I started speaking this morning. I said a little prayer, and I asked God, God, help me to help somebody. Maybe it's a lady who's almost 70 or who's 80 and thinks that it's hopeless, they're too old. Maybe that's one of the things that can come out of my talk this morning, that I can give hope to people that you're never too old. You're never too old to get the joy and the help from this way of life. Now, the next thing I want to call to your attention is the bottom of page 14, the top of page 15, that, again, this is Bill Wilson, who wrote the big book and who founded Alcoholics Anonymous. He's talking about that he has to practice these principles in all his affairs, and that he must perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, and now we're at the top of 15, through work and self-sacrifice for others. He talks in the next paragraph on page 15 about how life was not always easy, and this is something that I think is so important for us to know, that when he was plagued with waves of self-pity and resentment, and he nearly went back to drink, he found when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. And, you know, I want to just say on that score that the 10 years that I have been really so fortunate to have experienced maintenance and a release from the obsession of compulsive overeating, from the decade of my life, from age 70 to age 80, in that decade, I've had many challenges, many things which could have easily driven me back to binging and putting back 100 pounds plus. I could be easily a 350-pound, 80-year-old woman today. What happened in that decade of my life? And because here on page 15, Bill is saying, when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. It's a design for living that works in rough going. What was my rough going in those 10 years? Well, not only did I retire from my legal practice, which of course is a huge adjustment, especially for a workaholic like me, but also my brother moved out from New York and lived next door to us in Illinois, and we helped him in the last 5 years of his life. He was very ill, and we eventually got hospice, and he was right next door. I mean, literally next door in our condo building, and I was with him when he died. And it did not affect my ability to eat in an abstinent way. And I continued to go to meetings every day. This continued. I remember sitting by his bed, and he had passed away, reading prayers from the big book. Because as I say, I didn't have a background of prayers to say. But the big book gave me the words, the beautiful words, and I read them sitting by my brother's bed, and he was laying there, and he had passed away. So when I look at page 15, a design for living that works in rough going, that certainly has been the case for me. Also in those 10 years, I was in the hospital several times with a very serious matter, which fortunately I'm fine today, but it was very serious. And the move to Tennessee, a huge adjustment, moving from Illinois to a whole new environment in Tennessee. And so this is a program for the good times and the bad times. It says at the top of page 15 that unless we perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, there's the altruism, you cannot survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. Certain meaning it's going to happen. Life is going to have its ups and downs. Now, the next page I'd like to look at is page 20. So let's take a look at that. Hey, the big book is telling us that at the top of page 20, and this is in the chapter, There is a Solution, that our very lives, and I'm going to say as ex-problem compulsive overeaters, depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And this is where we can see the stark difference between just a diet program, which many of us have tried. I've certainly tried many different kinds of weight loss strategies. But our lives depend on our constant thought of others, constant, and how we may help meet their needs. And that explains why Overeaters Anonymous is so unique. It's such a unique spiritual program because it's directing us to live our lives where we depend upon our constant thought of others. So the constant thought of others replaces the constant thought of food. The next page I'd like to point out is page 63. Page 63 is a page devoted to third step prayer and this new way of life where we're offering ourselves to God, to God, build with me and do with me as thou wilt, relieve me of the bondage of self. And it says at the top of page 63 in that wonderful paragraph, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested. That is our whole new way of living. We turn from a person who's interested in their binge foods and in stuffing down their feelings and getting more and more food and the joy of our binge foods that lasts for just a few seconds, we're trading that in and we're becoming less and less interested in ourselves, and I'm going to say, and food, our little plans and designs, our strategies for getting food. And more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. Next, I want to look at page 84. And you know, page 84 is famous for the instructions for doing a step 10. And the step 10 is the wonderful mechanism in our 12-step way of life for helping us to deal with our feelings. And we are sensitive people as compulsive overeaters, and we have intense feelings. What do we do with these intense feelings? We do a step 10, and the instructions are on page 84. And the step 10 ends with this thought, right at the end of step 10, the instructions. After you've done your step 10, it says, then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Altruism, there it is. This is our way of life. We do these step 10s to get out our feelings, our selfishness, our dishonesty, our resentment, and our fear. Just normal human emotions that will pop up on a daily basis. And we can get rid of those intense feelings by doing a step 10. And after we do that, this beautiful way of life says, now turn your thoughts to someone you can help. So now our mind is filled with, who can I help? Instead of whatever upset me that led me to do a step 10, now my mind is filled with thoughts of helping someone else. So that's the beautiful program we have here. And then the nightly review on page 86, the top of 86, what we say each night as we go to bed. Step 11. Step 11, one of the many key questions that we're supposed to ask ourselves every night when we are ready to go to sleep, questions is, were you thinking about what you could do for others, of what you could pack into the stream of life? And that thought, asking yourself that every single night for the rest of your life. Was I thinking of what I could do for others? We grow spiritually when we ask ourselves questions like that. And the big book is telling us, ask yourself that every single night. So that's a wonderful built-in structure in our program. Next, I want to take a look at page 89. Now, page 89 is the beginning of step 12. That whole chapter, working with others, is devoted to the 12th step. And it tells us right on the first page, you can help when no one else can. That's a gift. That's one of the great gifts of this program, is having suffered with this disease, and yes, we really suffer with this disease. Terrible, terrible suffering with this disease. But now you're recovered, and you can help when no one else can, and how wonderful that is. The bottom of page 89 says, to be helpful is our only aim. Only aim. That's what we're trying to do when we carry this message. Our only aim is to be helpful. We're not trying to convert anybody. We're not trying to control anybody or tell them how to live their life. It's to be helpful. And on page 97, still in the same chapter, working with others, towards the top of the page, helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. You have to act a good Samaritan every day if need be. So there's the encouragement that if you want to keep your recovery, I mean, we think about what the foundation stone means. So often in this book, they use construction examples. Helping others is the foundation stone. So our recovery rests on that. Page 102. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. Again, the spirit of altruism. Now, I'm going to just kind of combine the ones that are left because for respect for time, because I do want to leave time for questions and answers. I want to say that there's so many other wonderful places in the book where altruism is mentioned. I want to just end with Dr. Bob's words. Dr. Bob, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, along with Bill W. Dr. Bob answers the question why he spends a great deal of time passing on what he learned. He says, to others who want and need it badly, and he says he does it for four reasons. This is at the end of his story, which is the first story in the back of the book. And this is page 181, where he talks about why he spends, and here he was a busy doctor, and he would spend all his free time helping other suffering alcoholics. Why did he do this? Here's his four reasons. Sense of duty is number one. Number two, it is a pleasure. Number three, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Number four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And with that, I pass. Thank you.
Oh, Nancy, thank you so much. There's just for your warmth and compassion and kind kind, very relatable message this morning. God's handiwork was on full display this morning, so thank you so much. We appreciate it. And I'm going to give you, before we transition to Q&A, first, if you want Nancy's contact information, stick around till the end of the recorded portion after the Q&A. We'll ask Nancy for that. Let me also give you the share ID number for the presentation this morning. That number is 22,844. That's 22844. So let's now transition to Q&A. If you have a question for Nancy, questions only, please. One per customer, please. Just in the interest of time, give me your first name and last initial and press star one to unmute your number. Who has a question for Nancy?
Hi, can you hear me? I'm Susie.
Yeah. Susie. Okay, Loretta, hold on,
a.
Susie. And Loretta. Who else?
Bonnie B.
Bonnie.
Kelsey R.
Say that again. Something R?
Kelsey R.
Kelsey. Gotcha, Kelsey. Anybody else?
Gianna in Ohio.
Was that Gianna?
Gianna, K-E-Y. Gianna, thank you.
Gianna. Gotcha, Gianna. Who else? Okay, here's who I heard. I heard Susie, Loretta, Bonnie, Kelsey, and Gianna. Anybody else want to join them? Okay, so we'll start with, if you're not Susie, if you would mute your phone again, and Susie with a question. Good morning, Susie. Susie, press star one.
Okay, here we go.
There you are. Hello.
All right. I didn't catch the speaker's name.
Nancy.
But Nancy, okay. Nancy, I'm trying to put together summer.
Susie, for some reason, I can't hear you. Maybe you can try something with your phone. Let's come back to you if I can, if you can see if you perhaps call back in. Let's go with a question from Loretta. Loretta, good morning.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning all along with my precious God. You are saving my life. Nancy, thank you very, very much, and I will listen to this again. And you talked about altruism, and you talked about this wonderful husband that you have that actually has helped and supported you through this. But how do you give him and your family that weight and measuredness that we do in our food plan, that we try to do with our lives today in your marriage? Because that has been a little bit of difficulty for me, especially being that this program has saved my life. And I want to share it with other suffering fellows, but I also, as it says in the big book, need to do this service in my home. Thank you.
Yes, Loretta, what I'm going to say is this program certainly impacts relationships. And I find that I do 10 steps about my husband more than anyone else, because even though I love him, I respect him, appreciate him, he's just a wonderful guy. But I'm a human being, and I get irritated over nothing, because it's a marriage and we're human beings. And as I say, we're married for 56 years. It's a joke, but it's true. He gets mad at me for the way I load the dishwasher. He said, "Nancy, you never do it the right way." And then I get irritated that he's irritated at me, and I could get into kind of a bad mood. And then I'll say, "Walter, I'm sorry I said whatever it was." And we're just human. you continue to be human. You continue to have all the human emotions. The difference with our program is that when you realize that you owe somebody an amend, you say it. And it's funny, I'll apologize to my husband. I'll say, you know, Walter, I should not have said that. That was not very kind, and I'm sorry. And he'll smile and look at me and say, do you really mean that, or are you just saying that because you think you should because of your OA program? So I say, no, I really mean it. I'm really sorry. But it's a little joke between us where if I apologize, he'll say, do you really mean it? I'll go, yes, I do. And it's brought us close together. We're very fortunate to at this stage of our life to have this beautiful, the spirit of this program in our marriage and in our family. It's a wonderful thing. So I hope I answered your question.
Thanks, Loretta. Okay, Bonnie, let me come back and see if I can get Susie back in there. Susie, are you there? Yes, you do. Perfect.
Okay.
You do.
There's like an increase my volume option. Okay, Miss Nancy, I'm trying to throw together a newcomers workshop, but it's also designed for people who to go to Black, Indigenous, people of color meetings, okay? But there's just really very little service. And we're broaching that in some town hall meetings and are in my home meeting. And I'm kind of expanding it now to a wider audience. And I don't know if you're available to help me prepare for this workshop. It's at the end of the month. Your specific examples from the Big Book, I'm going to, you know, listen to your recording again, but I don't know if you're available to help me or speak maybe for 10 minutes, but I need your number, and I just really appreciate your presentation, really. It was very thorough, so thank you so much. My phone number, I'll leave it, and I'll wait.
You know what? Yeah, I'll tell you what, Susie, yeah, we don't leave the phone number here, but I'll tell you what, we will absolutely get you Nancy's number. If you're able to hang out till the end of it, yeah, that we get it once the recording stops there. And
sure.
I'm sure if you reach out to Nancy for $50, no, no, I'm kidding. No,
I have to go at the end of the hour. So
okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Well, her number is on the membership list through a Vision for You website. We're not going to leave the number on the recorded line, but if you would look that up, and my number's there as well, you can reach out to me. I'll get you Nancy's number. But I appreciate your question there, Susie. So let's move on.
Larry, let me say that there's a lot of Nancy's. And there's an awful lot of Nancy's in OA. So let me say it's Nancy J, like J like in Jell-O.
Thanks, Nancy. Yeah. Thanks, Nancy. Yeah, and it's Nancy J from Tennessee. Nancy, are you still listed under Illinois, or is that Tennessee now?
I never changed it. So if I never changed it, it could be changed. Maybe somebody caught it, but I never thought of changing it. But it's either Geneva, Illinois, or Piperton, Tennessee.
Yeah, one or the other, and I'm on there, Larry K. You can reach out to me, and I'll get you Nancy's number as well. Thanks, Susie. Let's move on to a question from Bonnie. Hey, Bonnie. Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you. Thank you so much for your service, Larry and Nancy. What a beautiful, beautiful presentation today. So here's my question. I tend to be an addict in all areas. And when it comes to service, I'm an addict in that area also. That has been probably a downfall. My husband just said yesterday, you know, I'd like to see you not do as much. And this is just like in every regard, right? If someone needs their house painted, I sign up. I mean, it's this kind of thing. So here's my question to you. I fully support, and I know that if I'm not of service, I'm going to be teetering in a spot I shouldn't be. But I how do you not make or okay, this is my question. I have a tendency to make an idol out of service. I do get a hit or it feels good to know that I've been helpful to others. It's that empty bucket sort of. I'm wondering if you've ever wrestled with that or that, you know, how do you moderate that? Because I lean into this and this is beautiful. I'm just not sure that I even balance that very well. So thanks again for your service.
Yes, Bonnie, that's a great question. I think many people wonder how many people should they sponsor? Should they accept another invitation to speak? Should they accept the responsibility of being the chair of their group or be in charge of various responsibilities? And so what it says on pages 86, 87, and 88 in the big book is how we are supposed to live our lives so that we have the joy of recovery. And so it says on page 86 that on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. You might be considering when you wake up, Bonnie, should I take another sponsee on or not? Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. So it goes on and tells us what to do. It says God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. So, I mean, this book is so wonderful. It's telling you on 86, 87, and 88 how to live your life, which is what you're talking about, Bonnie, is you're saying, how do I live my life with my husband and all my OA responsibilities, and how do I get it into the right balance? Well, you have a higher power that's going to help you. It says that in thinking about our day, we may face indecision. And it goes on. If you read 86, 87, and 88, you'll see again and again, it tells you we are constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves, and now I'm on 88, many times each day, thy will be done. So we no longer have to figure it out for ourselves. We have divine help. And with that, I pass. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thanks, Bonnie. Okay, by the way, Nancy J. is listed under Illinois present. So we just won't let her go from Illinois. So next up with a question. Next up with a question is Kelsey R. Good morning, Kelsey.
Hey, Larry. Thanks. This is Kelsey R. in Texas. Oh, Nancy, I love you. I appreciate you. So my question is, how do you sponsor so that you can set your sponsee up for passing along this message again and again? Thanks.
And so, Kelsey, just help me. Tell me what it is you're actually asking.
So if a sponsee call, or if a potential sponsee calls you and says, will you sponsor me? What does that first conversation look like, and how do you take them through the steps? Obviously, you can't go through everything, but just if you could summarize so that people could see how you sponsor.
Well, the first question would be, are we a good match? If somebody would call me and say, would you sponsor me? And I actually have an opening, because often I don't have an opening. You can only do so many at once, because my main function usually is taking the 12 steps, and you can only do that with so many at a time. But if I actually have the time to do that, I want to know if we're a good match, and I will tell them the things that I require as a sponsor, and then find out what their expectations are. What are they hoping from me as a sponsor? And so we talk and we try to honestly communicate what our expectations are from both ends and see if we're a good match. Often if if I am not available because I had too many people at that time, I have a little list I keep of other people who are available as sponsors. So I try to help people. If I can't sponsor them, I try to help them find somebody and give them strategies for finding people and try to help that way. So I hope, Kelsey, that's what you were asking. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Kelsey, for the question. Okay, Kiana, it's your turn. Good morning.
Hi, this is Kiana in Ohio, and thank you for your service, both. My question is, with your long marriage, how, and your husband knowing that you've been in program, how do you consistently stay at a place where you're not expecting him to own his part too? I don't know if you can relate to that or not, but if you can, would you mind giving any suggestions on that?
Certainly. You know, as I say, we're just human. My husband and I are human, and sometimes our fights are so silly. We're so, it's like we're making the bed together, and I say, you're pulling the cover the wrong way. And he goes, no, you're the one who's pulling it the wrong way. I mean, we sound ridiculous a lot of the time. And we laugh at a lot of it. Some of it's not so funny. We really get irritated. And, you know, it's love and respect. It's love and respect for each other. I'm just very fortunate who I married, a very, very good, kind person. But he gets irritated with me. I get irritated with him. And the big book doesn't tell us to force the other person to admit their faults. That part is missing from the big book. It doesn't say make amends and also make sure the other person also makes amends and also admits their part. No, we just do our part, which is if we've caused harm, and that's the only time you make amends, is if you actually feel you've caused harm. And you leave it to the other person to live their life. And what the big book tells us in many different ways, and in many of the stories in the back of the book, directly or indirectly address this, as you change, as you recover, people around you recover as well. Or at least if not fully recovering, they benefit as well. And so you really leave it up to God to work on the people around you. All that we work on is ourselves, in the hope that by us working on ourselves, the people we love and we care about are going to benefit. But we don't directly make that happen. Our efforts are, and again, page 86, 87, and 88, is to live a spiritual life and hope that others around us will very much benefit from that. And with that, I pass. Thank you.
Kiana. Okay, we have time perhaps for a couple more questions. Press star one if you have a question for Nancy.
Elaine F. Honey, yes. New York.
Elaine.
Jackie A. from Connecticut.
Okay, let's close with Jackie. So we got Elaine, Hanayeta, and Jackie. Let's start with Elaine with a question. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning. Hi, Nancy. Thank you so much for your incredible share, and thank you, Larry. Nancy, I just so appreciate what you've said, and I can totally feel, you know, I feel so much of what you feel and the love that comes from, you know, being unblocked from God. And my question for you is, have you had any short or any kind of relapses in the last 10 years since you've come back to program? And also, how do you help your sponsees who've relapsed?
Okay. Elaine, thank you for the question. I'll give you an example with bread. Now, I'm a breadaholic, and what I have found is if I keep bread in the house, it should be Ezekiel bread. Because for me, Ezekiel bread is good, but it's not a binge food for me. It's not so tempting. And I have had white bread in the house for my husband. And I talk myself, instead of having one slice, which is what I was planning on doing, is having two slices. And then thinking to myself, Nancy, that's not a good choice for you. It's not. I call it not a good choice. I don't say, oh my gosh, I've relapsed. And I think if you're overly dramatic about choices you make with food, it's counterproductive. I personally encourage for myself and for the people I sponsor to say, are you better off without it? Is it a good choice? And to look upon it that way, I only consider a relapse in my mind is something major, like a big bowl of ice cream or cookies or eating cake or something major. And the reason I say that is I hear people saying, I had a relapse, and it could be something. I'll say, well, what exactly did you eat? What exactly did you do? I think it is important to make those distinctions. I think it's very important. I think actually sometimes we exaggerate what we did to give us an excuse to completely relapse. It's like a prelapse. It's like, okay, you made a bad food choice or a mistake, but does that mean you're now going to put on 100 pounds? So I think you have to use common sense, and that's one of the hard parts of being a compulsive overeater compared to an alcoholic. An alcoholic just stops drinking. But a compulsive overeater keeps on eating, and they eat at home, and they eat at parties, and they eat at restaurants. And you have to develop an attitude that you're going to make good food choices, and you're going to be honest with yourself, especially about what is a good food choice for you, because a nutritionist doesn't know. Yes, a nutritionist might give you a list of what you can eat, but they don't know what you're addicted to. And I think what's important is for you to be honest with yourself. And another example for me would be oranges. Now, I was fine eating an orange a day for a while, and then pretty soon it was two oranges, and I even talked myself into a third. And I thought, Nancy, don't buy any more oranges. I don't consider that a relapse, but I consider it something didn't look right to me in the way I was eating, and I made an adjustment. And that's what I think we have to be willing to do. So I hope that answers your question.
Thanks so much for that question, Elaine. Okay, Hanayeta, your turn. Good morning.
Good morning, Larry. This is Hanayeta from Texas. So first, Nancy, you are like, well, we have so much in common. I am, for my 75th birthday, which is next week, I am actually going to the convention, yay, for my birthday present. So I understand what you said. But my question is, do you devote so much time a day to be with your husband? Like, I try to make sure that from 7 o'clock on, I don't get any calls, or I don't take any calls, so that I can spend that time the rest of the night with my husband. Do you have something like that? Because also, you know, my program did get in the way of a lot of time with him, too. So anyway, that's my question. Do you have a special time for your husband?
Well, I'd say the answer is that we don't formally do that. We
we're both retired, and we live in a house by ourselves here in Tennessee. And like when I get off the phone now, I'm going to go look for him because I just enjoy being with him. And I will tell him about the meeting, and he'll say, how did it go? And we'll talk for a few minutes. Then he does his thing. I do my thing. He went to the mailbox yesterday. He said to me, you want to come along with me? And I have to go to Costco and get some glasses repaired, and he'll drive along with me. He drove me to the doctor the other day. Now, I drive just fine, but he came along with me. So we're just each other's companion at this stage of life. And so it isn't like a plan. That kind of thing, planning a date night or planning time, might have been more important when we were first married and our children were young. But I don't find right now that we need it, only because our particular lifestyle right now, we so much include each other in everything we do that the reason we came to this part of Tennessee, by the way, is because our granddaughter lives 10 minutes away in Collierville, Tennessee, 10 minutes away with our three great-grandchildren. And we get to see them all the time, which is, of course, wonderful. And that's why we picked this area. So a lot of what we do includes each other. My husband will say, you want to sit out on the porch for a few minutes? And we'll just sit and talk. It's not a planned thing, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, thank you. By the way, it's my 75th birthday, and we've also been married like 54 years. So thanks.
You're a newlywed.
Thanks, Anietta. Let's wrap up with the last question from Jackie. Jackie, good morning. Jackie, star one.
Good morning, Mr. Larry K. and everybody on the line. Thank you so much. And thank you, Ms. Nancy J. My question to you has to do with perfectionism. And I just hear this gentleness and ease. And it was very similar to Miss Elaine's question. As you define your abstinence and even just like weighing yourself daily, how did you get to that point of ease with your program when you were talking about like a slip versus a relapse and not being so hard on yourself? Like I think of the Big Book and I think of how these folks used tranquilizers. They used sedatives on themselves. They ate candy. They drink a lot of coffee and smoked cigarettes. So I felt like it was just like a lot of like passing the whack-a-mole to other diseases and focusing on first things first. So my question is kind of like, how did you balance that line for yourself of not passing a whack-a-mole or justifying too much, but also not being so perfectionistic that like you're militant about it?
Well, that's a great question. And I could say I'm still working on it. This is not easy. This is not easy. I've heard many very smart people say the hardest addiction is compulsive overeating. And it's because there are so many decisions we have to make. And now, of course, you have a higher power. This is a spiritual program. And it's a program where I think you get to love yourself more and more and accept yourself with all your imperfections more and more. And a lot of it goes back to this altruism and that you are useful. You know, somebody very wise in the program said recently to me, in recovery, you will find your greatest purpose in life. We're finding our greatest purpose. And I think when you find your greatest purpose, and of course, that's a tremendous gift as you get older. What is your
especially after you retire, what is your greatest purpose in life? It's in recovery and passing this message along. And so your self-esteem, your self-love grows, and I think you're less likely to beat yourself up on these small errors in judgment with food or just plain old bad choice. And then how do you learn from that, and how are you going to adjust your food plan as a result of that? I think it happens naturally as you recover, is what I'm saying.
Thanks so much for the question, Jackie. And Nancy, once again, we're so appreciative of your generous time this morning. And we appreciate you so much. And so now we're going to close and hang out as soon as we do. At the end of the recording, we'll ask Nancy for her contact information. So we're going to close from page 164 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.